Hello, this is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Georgina Godwin. And today you join us for this week's literary conversation. On our bookshelf, we have three non-fiction reads for you. And our expert on hand to talk us through them is the author and journalist Mark Mason. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, it seems that the world's fascination with Donald Trump isn't about to ease up any time soon. With the elections drawing nearer, everyone, of course, has an opinion or a story about him. So last week on the Monocle Arts Review, we discuss podcasts about the presidential candidate. And this week, we have one of the probably many books. It's called Trump and Me, and it's by a writer for The New Yorker, Mark Singer. It explores his experiences with Donald Trump. Mark, there's so much noise about Trump at the moment. So did this book particularly stand out for you?
I liked it because it was personal access. It wasn't just based on what we all think of him. We can all watch his speeches on Twitter, and we can all watch the brilliant, have you seen the I've Had the Time of My Life montage someone has put together from the debate the other night? They've put I've Had the Time of My Life, or whatever that song's called, from Dirty Dancing. Uh-huh. And they've managed to sync the lip movements of Trump and Clinton with the handheld mic to that song. So we can all watch that, we can all have an opinion, but this, it's basically an extended version of a New Yorker article, a profile that Mark Singer wrote about Trump many years ago. I think it's back in the 90s.
Yeah, 1996,
And Tina Brown got him to do it. And he got loads of time with Trump. And so there's fascinating insights into the private life, like living on flying on his jet on Trump Force One or whatever he calls it. Anyway, Trump, his private jet, yeah. Where everything, of course, is fake mahogany. Well, probably real mahogany and gold taps and all that sort of stuff.
Whale foreskins.
Yeah. That was Onassis, wasn't it? Yeah. But he's in back in those days, it was VHS. They're watching a VHS video of a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. And Trump's son is with them on the flight. And Trump keeps directing his son to fast forward through all the dialogue and the plot just to the action movies. He said, my aim is to get this two-hour movie down to 45 minutes. Which, you know, trivial little incident, but it tells you a lot about Donald Trump, I think.
Absolutely. And a lot there that we didn't really know already, would you say?
Certainly from the inside stuff and the like I say, the stuff that you would think is what politicians always call tittle-tattle, but tells you a lot. The nature of Trump's hotels. Singer quotes someone who'd stayed at one of Trump's hotels in, I think, Florida, and had been given the most luxurious suite. And there's a bowl of fruit outside one of the bathrooms in this suite. And the guy goes in just for a pee, as he says. I just went in for a pee. So just for something to do, as you do in places like that. Takes a kumquat from the fruit bowl as he goes into the bathroom just for a pee. So presumably, I don't know how he's eating a kumquat while he's in there, but anyway, takes it in there. By the time he comes out, just from having that pee, the kumquat has been replaced in the fruit bowl. So that's the sort of world that Donald Trump lives in.
Does it leave the reader feeling better or worse about him?
It's not going to win you over, I don't think. I don't think it's going to change. Trump is a cartoon figure. He's not there for people to change their minds about. He's there for you to love or hate and you stick with him. But I think there are insights. Yeah, he's at one point Singer says he has aspired to and achieved the ultimate luxury. An existence unmolested by the rumbling of a soul.
Oh, that's a fantastic line.
And you do get that impression that there really isn't anything there. And having read it and then watching the first two debates, there was that point the other night when Trump said to Clinton, I wasn't going to say this, and I hate to say this, but if I get elected, I'm going to get my attorney general to look at your emails and threatening her. And having read the book, I get the impression he just made that up on the spot. You know, we don't know because we haven't been there with his spin doctors seeing how it's planned. Mm. But I watch him now, having read the book, think he's just making it up as he goes along. Mm. Because that's got him billions of dollars. Okay, it hasn't got him as many billions of dollars as he would like you to believe if you believe Forbes magazine. Mm. And there's a lot of that in this book about his ongoing debate with Forbes that they refuse to believe he's worth as much as he is. And there's a fantastic detail that in one of his debt restructurings, because it's all been built on debt and it's come very, very close to crashing a lot, you know, several times. One of his debt restructurings in the early 1990s, Donald Trump, one of the conditions he had to agree to was that he would limit his personal spending to $450,000 a month. You know, that's the sort of world you're dealing with.
Yeah. I wonder if it gives any idea of his development from business to politics.
Yes, there isn't any. I think that existence of a soul thing, I think, sums it up. There really isn't anything there. And it's just, he's a rich kid, famously inherited a lot from his dad. What's the next toy? Oh, let's have a go at the White House. Mm. There's nothing more than that, really.
Trump and Me by Mark Singer. It's out now. It's published by Penguin. Well, we're sticking with politics now for a study of flags. Worth Dying For, The Power and Politics of Flags, is the latest book by writer and regular Monocle 24 contributor Tim Marshall. The book explores the symbols that represent national identity, patriotism and communal beliefs. Mark, do you think the book sets out to tell the history behind a flag or what it stands for once it's flown?
I think both. Certainly concentrating more on, I think, the history of it. He's not getting too philosophical about, you know, the nature of what it means to be a country, or, you know, there's a lot in there of the stories of just how the flags came to be designed and what they are said to stand for, and the things about how it's, the modern stories are really interesting. The South African one, the new South African flag, post-apartheid, they obviously wanted a new flag to symbolise the new country, and they'd got someone to design it. And it's actually, if you know the flag, it's quite complicated. There's a V coming in from the left-hand side with a straight line, and it's split up into different segments and several different colours going on. And they had to fax it to Nelson Mandela, because everyone knew Mandela was going to win the election. He was going to be the next president. So they faxed it, as it was in those days, for his approval. But his fax was only in black and white. So someone had to go down to the local corner shop to get some colouring pencils to colour it in. So there are lovely little stories like that. And there are things like... I love the detail about Afghanistan's flag, which it has its own code about how it should be displayed. And lots of countries have that in India, I think it is, only a certain number of people are allowed to fly the flag outside their official residence. And there are rules. The American one, you're not allowed to fly it at night. If it's an official building, you have to take it down each night, apart from a certain few, I think the White House, the Capitol, so on. But most official buildings have to take it down each night, and the flag isn't allowed to touch the ground when it's taken down. Whereas the British flag, when it's taken down, they deliberately let it touch the ground as a sort of sign of humility. But the Afghanistan one, part of its flag code, which was written in 1974, provides for, and I quote, the use of the national flag in any space vehicle Afghanistan may launch. There's always that bit of optimism there, you know?
That's extraordinary. So how's it structured? Does he concentrate on a select few case studies?
Quite a few, yeah. It's not a select few, but it's done geographically. Starts with the American one and then the British one, but then does it European, going to Asia. The Africa section is fascinating because there it's, of course, a lot of them are independence flags when they got their independence from various colonial powers in the second half of the 20th century. Mozambique is the only flag in the world to have an AK-47 on it. And as a sign of how these sort of things matter, the reason it's on there is that the government that's now in power, that got independence in the, I think, the 70s, the guys who are in power now are the freedom fighters who were using AK-47s back then as part of the War of Independence. And so they want it to stay on there. And the opposition politicians are saying, look, it's not giving a terribly good impression when it's flying outside the UN. It's the only modern weapon. There are swords on flags, but the only modern weapon on any flag of the world is this AK-47. And they say, please, can we take it off now? And the government won't let them do it.
Yeah. What about how flags have changed over the centuries, how the importance of them has changed?
It hasn't really changed that much. The passions are still the same, and they refer back. The modern flags will refer back to events from, you know, 1,000 years ago. Portugal has got 5 blue shields on its flag, each of which has 5 dots. They denote the Battle of Ourique. I hope I pronounced that correctly, where Alfonso I defeated 5 Moorish kings in the name of the 5 stigmata of Christ. Ooh. And that battle was in 1139. So these things are hanging around and they matter, you know?
Yeah, and as a mark of territory, I mean, does he discuss that whole kind of signs of patriotism?
Yeah, and that's what the whole... It's very often to do with battles, which is why there's always a lot of blood there. And I'm now trying to remember which country it is. Austria's flag is red with a horizontal white stripe. And that's said to hark back to Duke Leopold V, in the Siege of Acre, which was 1189 to 91, and he supposedly took off his belt from at the end of a day out fighting, where he'd got his whole tunic had got spattered in blood. So when he took off his belt, there was the one remaining white stripe, which hadn't got. So that is now what the Austrian flag is. Yeah, it's a bloody history.
It sounds extraordinary, worth dying for. The Power and Politics of Flags. It's by Tim Marshall. It's out now and it's published by Elliott and Thompson. So our final book takes us out of the political world and into the wonders of language. Dense Modern Tribes, the Secret Language of Britain, is a study into the lexicon of different social groups within the British Isles, from cabbies to footballers to pub landlords. Written by writer and television personality Susie Dent, it celebrates the way that the English language is used. So, Mark, what sort of research did she undertake to write the book?
Lots. And there's no one set way of doing the. I've done a similar book of this myself. The only way to research this is to talk to everybody, because the way tribes are defined in the book is anything you could think of as a tribe. You know, bin men, barristers, surfers, cabin crew. Cabin crew. One of my favourite terms was from the cabin crew. The crotch watch. When they at the beginning of the flight, when they check you've got your seatbelt on, they call that the crotch watch. So it's just going around asking people and. It's, you know, she as Susie Dent is on record now on Twitter the other day. She said that she's an Arsenal fan. She was delighted when Arsene Wenger gave her some football terms by email. So it's just a case of getting out there and asking and speaking to the people who do it. And to the extent of train spotters, which I don't know how much this travels around the world. It's a very British thing. I suppose there must be train spotters in America and places, but people who just collect the numbers of trains. Even within their group, there are subsections, and one set of train spotters will have slang terms for the other set of train spotters. There are some that are known as kettle bashers, and they're spotters who are obsessed with steam trains, hence kettle. And then surfers have, I did like the surfer one about hanging 10. When you, if you're surfing, if you hang 10, if you've got with all 10 toes over the edge of the board. And then male surfers, if they ride naked, that's known as hanging 11. So there's a lot of wit and invention in these things.
Oh, that's so funny. So what does she discover about what people might deem to be jargon? I mean, you've given us examples of various ones, but I wonder how aware people are of their own jargon. So, for instance, cab drivers, I know, really speak a completely different language.
Yeah, absolutely. And very often, a cabbie is a very good term. Especially at the moment in London with black cab drivers, the licensed ones, who have to do the knowledge, which is fantastically complex, takes years. They are now up against Uber, who are opening in lots of cities around the world. And very often a lot of this slang, you get the impression from reading the book, it's about self-identification. It's, you know what you're talking about, but the fact that you have a special term for it, which only you use, reinforces your sense of almost like a trade union thing. And the cabbies have got that, as I say, going on at the moment.
Clearly you'd recommend this book. It sounds fantastic.
It's great fun.
Dense Modern Tribes, The Secret Language of Britain by Susie Dent is out on October the 20th. It's published by John Murray. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Very many thanks to my guest, Mark Mason. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Georgina Godwin. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Do join us at the same time tomorrow when we'll be talking film. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.